An evening of lively, smart conversation and jazz. Join me, John Williams, for a live taping of the Mincing Rascals podcast, Robert's Pizza, and Jazz, Wednesday, June 12th, 6 to 8 at Winter's Jazz Club in Streeterville. Tickets at WGNRadio.com/rascals. Today is Wednesday, April 10th, 2024. And it is 2:40 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast. You can email us, and you have been, to John Williams at WGNRadio.com. We'll review some of your messages to us at the end of the pod. And you can listen to me weekdays on WGN from 10 to 2.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter, columnist, and now writing the Chicago history website, Roseland Chicago 1972.
Hey, it's Brandon Pope, host of On the Block, powered by Block Club Chicago on WCIU.
I'm Marge Halperin, a communications consultant with a couple of decades of political experience. And as a pundit, I'm currently featured on Canada's CTV, the national news network.
I'm Eric Zorn, the editor and publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, a weekly Substack newsletter.
On March 21st, Chicago police stopped a vehicle being driven by a Dexter Reed Jr. Reed was known to police, having recently appeared in court on charges of illegally carrying a .357 Magnum in his pants while walking into a street festival. In this case, police say they pulled him over for not wearing his seatbelt. Officers approached his car and demanded that he open the door, a door whose windows were tinted. After a brief standoff, a shot, maybe 11 shots, was fired from inside the vehicle. And then four police officers opened fire, shooting approximately 96 times in 41 seconds. Reed was killed. One officer was wounded in the forearm. The two wows in this story to me are 96 shots in 41 seconds. And the other head-scratcher is a seatbelt violation? Seriously? But no matter what else this case says about people and policing, guys, this is true. If the police point a gun at you and say, open the door, open the door.
I have the same sort of first two thoughts that you do. One is seatbelt violation. It seems so pretextual, right? It's like there's some other reason that they were stopping this car. And I don't know why they would come up with something like a seatbelt, but they did. And to have four plainclothes officers jump out of a car pointing guns at somebody for not wearing a seatbelt, it doesn't make any sense to me. 96 shots seems like excessive overkill, so to speak. I mean, just the idea that they would continue firing. Several shots were fired when he was lying motionless on the ground. Now, I get not dropping your gun and just wandering over to him, but they had their weapons on him. He was down. He didn't have a gun in his hand. I don't think they knew that, but it's just there's something about it that really is troubling. On the other hand, there is, as you said, you cooperate with police, you don't shoot at them, and because it's never going to end well. And that's those are my three thoughts, and they I feel like they're in tension in a way, like they're in conflict.
As soon as you say one, people say, what about the other? And I've held both of those views, and I think you can.
It's one of those things where you gotta be able to. There's so many layers to this. 96 shots is extremely excessive, but also firing at a police officer is also completely uncalled for. I want to give credit to Mayor Brandon Johnson. I think he did a good job in his response to this and talking about how, you know, his concern for the officer and how two black men could have lost their life. I do think when you zoom out, you know, it just came out today from Block Club Chicago that the officers that did this traffic stop are also under investigation for another traffic stop. This area of Chicago is well documented and known to have numerous complaints from citizens in the area of police just being completely over-escalating situations. And this seemed like an example of an over-escalation. Why do you need all those police officers in plain clothes for a seatbelt violation? It seems extremely excessive.
They were in one vehicle, though.
Yeah. It's a lot. And I just wish and hope that the family of the officer who shot and the officer himself is going to be okay. I'm praying for the family of Dexter Reed.
There's still some questions about that, aren't there? I mean, I thought it was odd that the cop who was shot was on the passenger side. When the story first started coming out, I thought he had a passenger in there who may have shot. Does it make sense that he's addressing the officers? They're all crowded around his window, and he turns around and he shoots the guy on the other side, who also, by the way, is in the line of fire of the other officers who are shooting wildly 96 times or 50 times before he falls out of the car. And also, they found a gun. I mean, forgive me for being skeptical, but there are so many cases in history from John Burge and others where a gun is found at the scene, and it wasn't the guy's gun. It was planted. I saw, just before we came on, I saw from one of the police body cam recordings, there's a female officer there, and somebody said, the guy who shot, I believe it's the officer who was shooting at Mr. Reed on the ground, who says, did he shoot at us first? And she says, don't talk, don't say anything. Do you hear me? Because she knows the body cam's running.
Yeah, I noticed that.
I don't want to accept any of these facts until an investigation is done. But the last one point of question is what Brandon just said was addressed in the COPA letter, skeptical as it was, saying that COPA, being the oversight board, and the woman who runs it wrote a letter yesterday raising some questions, one of which being, how could they have seen the seatbelt since they were behind the car at some distance, had an odd angle, and the windows were heavily tinted, and also noting that they are under investigation for a similar seatbelt stop. If I were covering this story, I would be sending in a FOIA right away that asks, how many seatbelt stops has this group of officers undertaken, and to what end in recent months or longer? This is like core to the Chicago Police problem. The system is broken in all these ways. I don't know how and who is going to fix it, or how many more people are going to be killed for seatbelt violations or driving while black.
But it's also plausible that he would have a gun, since he was just a couple of weeks prior brought up on charges of having a 357.
That's right.
I don't think that that's the red flag that you're making it out to be, Marge. And I also imagine they could have looked through the windshield of the car. I mean, it's a plausible scenario where the two cars are coming in opposite directions, facing each other. They look in, they see that this person isn't wearing a seatbelt. They run the plates, maybe. This is as plausible as anything. And they go, that's that guy. The police are being asked to take guns off the street. I have no reason to doubt that he did have a gun in that car.
I want to amplify something that Marge said about that we don't know about the ballistics here. And that's what's curious to me, is this video has been released, but the ballistics report has not been done. If that is his gun, and I'm assuming that it was, and I'm assuming that he fired first, and I'm assuming things that I've been told, and of course, I think an investigation is warranted. But I would think that by now the ballistics report would tell us that the bullet that shot the officer was likely a bullet from that gun, and that how many times that gun had been fired, if they have an estimate on that. So I think that's a really important thing.
Like Marge pointed out, the officer who got shot was on the passenger side while everyone else was kind of on the driver's side. And you really can't tell from his camera angle if that window ever came down. So I was wondering that too, Marge, but I'm assuming for now that it's true that Dexter Reed fired the first shot, because Andrea Kerner from COPA has voiced a lot of unease with the traffic stop and everything. And yet she is accepting that he fired the first shot. But also, I was kind of wondering, Andrea Kerner, even when you talk to
Kirsten,
her,
yeah.
I'm sorry, Kirsten. Kirsten, even when you talk to her, she always answers the question or the COPA people in their statement that, as far as we know, this is why they pulled him over. And they never say, because this is what the police say. I'm just wondering if they stopped because he was in the crosswalk. You know, they do that. especially in that particular district and another West Side district, they do these things.
And you I think mean, that's that? A whole, and what about that?
That's a whole other discussion.
Is that a problem? I mean, but they do the why do they do these things? Because they want to get shot? No, because maybe there's a gun in this vehicle. And assuming that that search is legal or that stop is legal, I don't have a problem with the police trying to approaching people who may have guns illegally and taking them off the streets.
That is a whole very big controversial thing for sure. I mean, just last week, there was a report put out by a, you know, police reform advocacy group talking about the vast increase in.
Oh, it's stunning. I have the report in front of me. The
number of people. Right, like over 500,000.
Right. And 80% of them are Black and Latino. And that hardly ever bears fruit. I understand that.
Criminal justice type people will tell you those type of traffic stops can be useful. So I think as a city, we really need to have that discussion and look at both sides. Is it in fact worthwhile for them to be making these type of stops or not? It's unclear to me.
Andrea Kirsten also told us, because we followed up after the interview, and I thought, I still don't know exactly why the police came upon this guy. Did they stop him while he was moving, or was he parked in the parking lot and they just on the side, the crosswalk, and they came upon him?
But I'm not sure.
What is the stated reason for that? And she said, all we are going on so far is that he did not have his seatbelt fastened. Brandon, why are you making that face over there?
I'm making a face. Overall, the whole question for me is, why was the stop made? I think that's the question people are asking. I'm glad you brought up those numbers about 80% of traffic stops the last year being Black and Latino, and less than 1% of them actually producing any guns or drugs. What that shows is a pattern of targeting people because of their race and suspicion on their race, and you don't get anything out of it. And there's already tense relationships and feelings within diverse communities when it comes to police. And I just feel like it's the responsibility of police departments, especially in cities like Chicago, one, to do the work to repair those relationships, but two, to police with the awareness of those relationships, with the knowledge that if you're going to have a police officer, not just one police officer, but multiple police officers stop somebody for a seatbelt, it automatically is going to raise tensions no matter what if the driver is Black. Just the facts. Me being a Black person, if it happened to me, I'm telling you what, I would also be scared for my life. I don't have a gun or drugs. I've had situations where I'm driving and it's like, why are there 7 cops here? what is the reason for that? Oh, I was going 5 miles over the speed limit. You're going to give me a warning, but what is all this for, right? Like, there's got to be some real training on de-escalation in these situations, especially when working with people of color, because overall, you're already going to automatically have distrust and raise tensions just from you bringing 7-8 cops to stop one guy for a seatbelt. This makes no sense, the numbers there to me.
They are purposely doing these stops in the high crime districts because they think there's value to it, where we're trying to rebuild a level of community and trust between the police and the neighborhoods. So it's definitely a discussion they need to have and decide whether or not they should be doing this tactic.
I would feel a lot more comfortable with this story, not that it's a comforting story, but that if the reason that they pulled him over made sense, and if they were to say, like, yeah, he was parked in the crosswalk and we thought that was weird and we wanted to take a look and then we ran the plates and we saw that it belonged to someone who had been arrested. It feels like they're lying about this. And when you sense that they're lying about that, you wonder what else they're lying about. That's just a terrible look for a police department. If they were to say, like, yeah, look, we pull over guys when we think they might, you know, there might be trouble. This is what we do. At least that's honest. You know, it's
you'd
debatable,
respect that.
But I'd respect that because I don't buy the seatbelt thing. I wear my seatbelt most of the time.
We're so early in this, though. We don't actually even know if that's their official line.
And yet, let me point out that all of us have said, and several of us use the phrase, I'm assuming this or that. I'm assuming he had a gun. I think, first of all, media overall should not be making any assumptions based on how mixed up this is and on the history that we know. Sometimes I think the only thing that's changed about policing in Chicago since Laquan McDonald was shot is that now we get to see the videos and they're all public. This deeply entrenched problem is not being addressed. There are countless studies, notably one that I saw, I don't know, 20 years ago, that tested police officers and shown their on computer testing, they are much more likely to hit the button to shoot if it's a person of color. Whether they're black cops, white cops, people of color, didn't matter. We know this is a trend. What are we doing about that? And then when you say, John, about, well, stop the car, maybe you get a gun. This is like the broken windows thing that Jerry McCarthy did in Chicago for a while until it was discredited. You know, clean up the neighborhood, stop somebody, arrest them, or make them fix their basement window when it's broken. These minor things are not helping our city. That kind of approach, if they're doing that as a drive-by, it's extremely dangerous because of the tensions on the street that we see that happens. I don't think that's a good method for getting guns off the streets, randomly stopping cars. Where's the science to that?
I don't know that it was entirely random, though, right?
We don't know.
Well, about how skewed the numbers are, where it's a vast majority of the people who are pulled over for sometimes these frivolous reasons, and it bears so little fruit, the vast majority of them are people of color. Those numbers need to be taken into some context, too. On the South and West Side, those are largely black areas, and those are largely high crime areas. So, of course, the numbers are going to be skewed that way. There aren't many white people over there to pull over to begin with. And we haven't talked a lot about a little sympathy for the police here who are standing on the other side of a tinted window and they don't know if there's a gun going to be pointed at them or not. And guess what? There was. You know, that officer on the passenger side who was shot never fired his weapon. The cops, to me, are in a little bit of a damned if you do, damned if you don't position.
There are so many tinted windows these days. I see them all the time, and I'm kind of surprised because I thought it was illegal, but it's not. It's
there's a shade. There's a measure.
It was,
and there is a measurement, and I know what the number is, but I never see a picture saying this is what it would look like.
I would like to see that.
You know, if it was legal. So 35% is that legal line. What does that look like? I don't know. I see a lot of people driving
35%
around.
35% is the number I heard, too.
Why not go to the places that do tint windows and fine them or arrest them or shut them down if they're doing the dark tinting? Has there been any attempt to crack down on that business? Because I think it's pretty clear a lot of cars.
I haven't heard about that, Marge, but you're going to hate this idea, Marge. Or let's just pull the cars over that have the tint and then get the little measuring device out. And if it's above grade, then you get a ticket.
Is there a measuring device?
There is. The Will County State's Attorney hands it out to police officers.
I hear this. And who cares about a window being tinted? Aren't there bigger issues to tackle in the city of Chicago than, oh, man, the windows are too dark? And also, I think about how we still have a Chicago police consent decree mandated by the U.S. Department of Justice. It's only 6% complete, and it was issued in 2019. Like, we would get some answers as to what police can do when it comes to escalation and de-escalation, probably a clearer picture if we actually made a bigger dent on that consent decree as well. So I think it once again highlights that we are lagging in the police reforms that we have espoused that have been talked about since George Floyd and Laquan McDonald. Chicago still lagging behind, and we still have many questions to answer here.
Yeah, you know, I'll bet Gregory Pratt could tell us something about why the police reforms have been slow.
There you are. Hi, Greg. How are you?
Hello. Good to see everybody.
All right, we're going to weave you into the conversation here. So Gregory Pratt, who is an investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune, and who it was our plan to invite in the pod today to talk about his new book, The City is Up for Grabs, How Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot Led and Lost a City in Crisis. A lot of us have read your book, Gregory, and I appreciate you joining us. But maybe you want to chime in on the conversation we're having here about this Dexter Reed story and the police shooting.
Well, this thing is a disaster to sort through. It's just a really messy situation where, no, we shouldn't have fired. The story about we saw the we saw he wasn't wearing a seatbelt. It's like, well, how did you see that through the tinted windows? And then why did five of you jump out? And they had a complaint recently about their issue. And so you have five guys surrounding, and then you have 96 shots, my understanding is one of the officers fired a huge number of those shots.
Yeah.
This is a textbook example of a police encounter that went wrong from just about every single standpoint. Like, you know, anytime a police department pulls someone over for a tinted window and it ends in 96 gunshots, is just not a good encounter for anybody. And I feel really bad for the officers, and I feel really bad for the victim here, but it's just really hard to fathom. How do you go up to a guy for a tinted window, and that's what we end up with? It's really tragic.
Or a seatbelt, or whatever. We were talking earlier, Greg, before you got on about it's really, it doesn't make sense that they say they pulled him over for not wearing a seatbelt, but then we're thinking that it might have been the tinted windows, or it might have been that he may have been parked in the crosswalk, but they weren't candid with us. Or they don't. It doesn't feel like they're being candid with us about why they've got out of their cars with their guns drawn, and that adds to the what's so disquieting about this story.
Well, sometimes, you know, one of the issues with the consent decree, and one of the issues under Mayor Lightfoot, which you can read about in The City Is Up for Grabs, was the failure to implement the consent decree fully and training. And I would really like to know what kind of training these officers had. And were they a little quick? Were they a little aggressive? You know, do you run up on a guy with plainclothes officers on the West Side over something frivolous like this? You know, were they kind of practicing is one of the things I wonder about. You know, these are this is a tack team. And so one of the things they do sometimes is pull people over. Now, to get their reps. I would like to know what kind of training these particular officers had. And these are all open questions, but the incident is a fail. And so far we haven't done a good enough job of professionalizing our police department.
De-escalation, right? If the idea was we got to write a ticket to this guy for not having his seatbelt fastened, how else could we have played this scene out, right? Now he's not cooperating. He's sitting there with the windows up. What do we do now? And shouting F-bombs and pointing guns at him is one strategy. What other tools do they have in their box, Greg? What else should they? They're going to let the guy drive away. What do they do next?
Good questions. One of the things I don't understand, they're a tack team. I mean, they're there to be the big boys going after the bad guys. They probably shouldn't be wasting their time with a seatbelt violation at all. If that's actually what they're doing, you know, the tack teams are the big dogs. You know, they're there to go after some serious stuff. And so that's one of the many things I am confused by with what was happening here.
And their history, apparently, of pulling over people for this same minor violation. What have they been doing? Joyriding in the neighborhood?
Maybe it's the same kind of person. Maybe the person with the tinted windows who doesn't have a seatbelt on is also a guy who's a known drug dealer or has done something that gives us sufficient pause to pull him over and see if he has illegal weapons. I mean, it could be the same person.
It's random and speculative. I don't think this is a good place for speculation on the streets of Chicago. Maybe, John, you might be right. But a lot of things we intuitively think turned out statistically not to be true. And I'm not sure that's how you run a police force.
Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting in The City Is Up for Grabs, which is Greg's book, and I can't recommend it highly enough. It's a terrific a recounting of the Lightfoot term, was her relationship with the police department, the way she brought in Superintendent Brown and the conversation she would have with them. Is any of that still lingering, Greg, as far as you know, in terms of how the police department feels about the city administration and the mayor's office?
Well, sure. You know, as far as the police department feels, they're ruled by communists and they don't want to deal with that. You know, that's a struggling thing. Mayor Johnson has been a lot savvier dealing with the police department. You know, he hired somebody that they trust. I was half joking with the earlier comment, but, you know, he hired somebody that every police officer has some trust and respect for in Larry Snelling. And so that's actually a pretty smart, savvy move, the likes of which Mayor Lightfoot did not do by bringing in Brown and having Eric Carter as his number two. And Eric Carter is a guy that got nicknamed Gaddafi because he has so many medals on his chest at all times. One of the things that you're seeing here, and you see it with this incident that you guys were just talking about, and you see it with the department in general, is we had four lost years in terms of good quality policing and oversight reform. And so you lost a lot of time and muscle memory. You had a lot of people leaving the department. You had brass leaving. You had officers leaving. And they weren't filling those positions or bringing in folks who probably needed to be empowered, like someone like Snelling.
It seemed like, and I'm reading it now through the lens of the Dexter Reed story and what we're talking about, but it seemed like policing, I don't want to make a short work of the COVID issue in the pandemic, but the threat in your book, which I have not finished yet, really seems to be policing. The threat in this city seems to be about police reform, which, as Brandon noted before you came on, you know, we're making pitiful progress toward the consent decree and true reform. That seemed to be what ushered Lightfoot in and out.
When you talk about the city of Chicago, when you travel abroad and you go to Croatia or you go to Iceland or Thailand and people say you're from Chicago, they'll ask you about two people, Michael Jordan and Al Capone. And Capone has been dead since 1947, but that's still one of the things that people want to talk about. They think of Chicago as the land of gangbangers and shoot 'em ups, and they romanticize it to a certain extent. The issues are not new in terms of policing and public safety. And so COVID's not the reason Mayor Lightfoot lost her reelection. I mean, it's not even a factor there. It's a factor that is positive in her favor in the collective memory. People remember the tough lady who was standing at a podium and saying, you know, don't kill grandma. And don't kill grandma by going out and being stupid and getting COVID. The issues in Chicago are crime and safety and community relations. And that's the issue for every mayor before and every mayor in the future. And so, those are questions that she got wrong from basically several different perspectives. And that's one of the things that the book kind of shows, the way that bringing in this outsider, David Brown, who didn't know the difference between a Chicago hot dog, which is real, and Chicago barbecue, which is not real, you know, that you have these types of problems. And so, yes, I think that's a good observation, that's one of the big through lines throughout the book.
Greg, I'd love to hear a little bit from you about the Anjanette Young case, because as you depict in the book, which, you know, as Eric already mentioned, everybody, if you're interested in Chicago politics, and you should be, go read it, because it's a great read. She kind of created her own Laquan McDonald issue with the Anjanette Young situation, with withholding the videotapes. But what I was wondering, if you could talk a little bit about it in general, but also tell us from your perspective to what extent this was kind of more on her law department, or to what extent she knew what they were doing in those moves.
Mayor Lightfoot, as far as I'm aware, and I do believe, was not aware that the department was trying to prevent the release of the videos to CBS or to Anjanette Young personally.
Tell us what that story is first, though, for those who are not familiar with it.
So Anjanette Young is a black social worker in the city of Chicago who was at home. She was getting changed. She's not wearing any clothes. The police bust into her house. They've got the wrong address. It happens a lot more often than you would think. They come in, they handcuff her while she's naked, and she's really upset about how she's treating. She says like 40 times, "You've got the wrong house." And they don't really clove her until Ella French, who is a police officer who was tragically killed in an entirely unrelated incident, shows her some humanity and dresses her. Anjanette Young sues the city. The city will not give her or her lawyer or the media the video. And they say, and I talk about this in the book, that it will look bad and that they will make it look worse than it really was by releasing the video, which is the law department's position. Mayor Lightfoot's top lawyer, Mark Flussner, his view was that, you know, she was only naked very briefly. And that's the law department's position on that. When CBS News gets the video from Young's lawyer, Mayor Lightfoot's law department goes to court and says, please don't let them publish this video. They got it improperly because they had gotten it subject to a confidentiality order. So it airs that night. And then the next morning, Mayor Lightfoot's at her 8 a.m. phone call with her staff. And someone says, did anyone see this video? And Mayor Lightfoot says, what video? And there's that. And then things start to unfold. You know, I start asking a lot of questions. CBS continues asking a lot of questions. What did you know? When did you know it? And Mayor Lightfoot gets really angry and says, this is the very first time I've ever heard of this case or this situation. And that's flat out untrue. She had received an explicit, well-written email from her deputy mayor for public safety about it about a year prior. And Mayor Lightfoot, and for your listeners, I used to get her emails every month. I used to get every email that she sent and received. She did not always respond right away. To the email from Susan Lee, her deputy mayor for public safety, she said, I have a lot of questions about this one. Can you call me in 15 minutes? So they end up having a meeting, a phone meeting, 15 minutes later. And so she was very interested in it. But she goes out and she flat out denies, I've never heard of this case. And she ends up the next day having to acknowledge that she had heard of the case and apologizing for it. She had built a, and this was true when she was in police oversight in 2002, because she used to work in the police department. She was very much an institutionalist of let's preserve the institution. That was true for the law department. They handled this like a corporate law firm. She ended up well over her skis. And what she would say about why she said these blatant falsehoods is that she forgot. Okay, but how am I supposed to believe anything you ever say again? Because this wasn't a, I don't recall. This was a, absolutely not. I wouldn't, you know, and you don't really forget this particular story. It's a pretty terrible story, especially, I would imagine if you're a black woman and you see this happen to another black woman, right? Like that this would be something that sticks with you.
Any woman.
Sure. But, you know, but Mayor Lightfoot is very, very vocal about her identity, right? So you would imagine that there's a special affinity there. And so it was interesting. And there's a little story behind the scenes where Kim Fox had criticized the city and the city for not releasing the video. Kim Fox later has a meeting with Lori Lightfoot months after she'd criticized her. And Lori says, you piled on and you shouldn't have. And Kim Fox says, I don't know what you're talking about. And she says, the Anjanette Young video, you shouldn't have said anything. Kim says, I didn't criticize you. I criticized the city. And Lori says, I am the city. And it's a really interesting moment where this was one of the lowest marks that she receives for how she handled Anjanette Young from beginning to end. And for me, it was always this myopic. Even in the early days, she was texting with Dorothy Brown, which is really remarkable to me because she shouldn't be communicating with nobody. Should talk to Dorothy Brown, you know, like and the reform. Former prosecutor, mayor of Chicago, should not be talking to Dorothy Brown. And they're going back and forth about how this is the ROM raid. She did not personally say, don't give them the video, but she empowered her law department to do it. And then she was not straight with the city about what had happened.
Hmm. You know, this reminded me of the Laquan McDonald video, which Rahm Emanuel insisted he'd never seen. I found that hard to believe. Unless he said, whatever you do, don't show me that video. I want to be able to say I never saw it. It was maybe splitting hairs. But in that same way, building up a sort of legal argument, plausible deniability, only she was maybe clumsier at it than he was. But I didn't believe him either.
I believe Rahm didn't see the video. I'm sure he knew why his law department was paying $6 million or whatever it was. I mean, they told him there's this is a bad shooting, you know, and. So, of course, at what point, at what moment, I'm not sure. But before they agreed to pay that money, of course, he had a good idea of that.
Whether he saw it or not was not the question. That was the problem with that. He knew minute by minute what was in it.
Greg, I can't imagine how you had time to read everybody else's email. But it's great, everybody, if you read the book, how much of their emails and texts, I think, that you were able to go through with your FOIA request. What is with these people? Everything they put in their emails and texts, knowing that they're all going to be publicly available. Yeah. I would be Paulie and Goodfellas. I'd be sending somebody to a payphone every 2 minutes. I would never be writing those emails.
Well, you know, there's a lot of substantive stuff in there. Let me just say that. And that's important for me to say, because I always talk about Lori life with crazy emails and text messages. There's a text message, but that said, there's some really good stuff in there. There's some really interesting stuff in there. I mean, one time she got mad at her staff, and she was sitting in what's called office time, which is when she gets time to herself. And she's angry that she's not getting enough office time. So she sends an email where she writes, I need office time every day. I need office time every day. And she writes it 16 times, and it comes off like The Shining, you know, all work and no play makes Lori a dull boy. And so every single person on this podcast would be fired from your workplace if you sent that email. They would say you had lost your mind. They would at least put you on a EAP assistance or something. And so I remember shortly after she had made the comments, and it came to light through the Tribune and through me that she had said that she had a bigger phallus than the Italians. She said, I don't talk like that. And there was a text message that she had sent about attorney Bert Odelson, who was representing the Latino caucus on something. And she said that Bert was out there stroking himself. And it's like, I mean, you know, that's kind of your language. And that was in writing, you know. So it's one of those things where the lady doth protest too much. And you know, every once in a while, and I don't want to beat on her too much about that. Like Rahm Emanuel used to deny saying F you to Karen Lewis. And it's like, come on. Rahm Emanuel says F you like some of us say good morning. I mean, it's not even an insult from him necessarily. And so it's but those are some of those texts. And what on a more substantive thing, she didn't text with the alderman as much as you would think, which was its own revelation. You know, if she was texting them, it was to yell at them. It wasn't to say, how was the flooding in Garfield Park? How was the derecho that hit the north side? Hey, I'm angry at you because of whatever. She texts Brendan Riley to tell him he's Bush League. And he's like, what did you say to me?
How do you explain her victory was resounding? And yet I think we from the get-go saw her as being very defensive. Where does that come from? Why was she not more considerate or appreciative or empathetic or
magnanimous?
Why? I mean, she had every opportunity, and your book's subtitle is how she led the city and then lost the city. And during the pandemic, we had great fondness for her. Not everybody agreed with her policies, but I think everybody respected and liked Lori Lightfoot. She was only mayor for 4 years, and most of them there was a pandemic. So why so defensive, and then how did she lose the city?
A lot of politicians don't understand why they win and why they lose. A lot, you know, Iris Martinez 4 years ago beat the people. She ran against three guys in the Democratic primary. She's the only woman. She's the only Latina. Divides the vote. That's why she won. She didn't win because of her intrinsic wonderful qualities. And actually, Iris Martinez gets beat up a lot. She's a pretty spectacular conversationalist. But the and similarly with Lori Lightfoot, she didn't win because everybody was in love with her forever and ever and wanted to make pinky promises and happiness forever. She won because she was running against someone who had just done an unpopular soda tax and who was tied to a federal corruption scandal that really shook up the race. If the Ed Burke stuff happens, Lori Lightfoot is back at Mayor Brown making $1 million a year, and she's probably a lot happier than she is right now. And so, you know, she never understood that. She thought that she won 76% of the vote because the voters loved her. And that's not really the case. They liked her. They wanted to give her a chance. And then they said, well, what is this? And so Rahm Emanuel used to go around town telling people that her support was a mile wide and an inch deep, which I think is true. And she didn't really get that. And so she thought that she could just run the way she ran. And one of the stories I tell in the book, Willie Wilson worked very hard to introduce her to Black Chicago and to take her around churches. And she dumped him before she even got sworn in. She thought that she was too good to continue that relationship before she had even become mayor. And so that was that's a pattern that repeated over and over. She just didn't understand.
Yeah, Greg, when I heard you on Ben Jarafsky's podcast the other day, and he asked you what you thought the mayor's biggest, Mayor Lightfoot's biggest mistake was in office, the one that immediately came to my mind was freezing out Willie Wilson, that she failed to realize that politics is about addition, not subtraction. And she pushed Willie Wilson away. She offended him. I think if she had just drawn him a little closer, listened to him, brought him in for a meeting once a month.
It was hard to take him seriously, Eric.
It is hard to take him seriously, but if you're a politician.
He's an institution.
He is an institution. And so he ran against her. And I don't know if you rewind the tape, if Willie Wilson took support from her or he took support from someone else. I think he got like 9% of the vote. It's kind of what he usually does. I don't remember what it was, but the people who voted for him, if he were out there plumping for Lori Lightfoot, she might have been in that runoff. She might have beaten Brandon Johnson. I mean, am I close there that was one of her biggest mistakes?
Yes, and politically, sure. And it's not just in a vacuum of Willie Wilson. It's also what it represents broadly, which this one really, if everything else is the same and she gets 5% of Willie Wilson's 9%, she ends up in the runoff and she beats Paul Vallis in all likelihood. Mm-hmm. It's not a guarantee, but she probably beats Paul. She probably doesn't beat anyone else of the serious candidates, but she wanted Paul and she thinks she can beat Paul. Her biggest failure and her problem was that she doesn't know how to maintain relationships and she doesn't have the self-awareness to acknowledge a mistake. And you saw that with David Brown, which was the other big mistake that she did. And so these two things were self-inflicted wounds that repeated over and over again with a cast of characters.
Yeah.
And no, she shouldn't have turned over the keys to the castle to Willie Wilson. But, you know, every mayor has friends and allies that perhaps you wouldn't want leading the city necessarily, but that you want to talk to and listen to and collaborate with. And by the way, Willie's not a total goof. I mean, he made himself rich with medical device supplies, and he's not a stupid man. He's a little bit of a cartoon to some people, but he is an icon in the city of Chicago, and he's not a stupid man.
Which is a point Brandon was making, and Brandon's got to click out here. But go ahead, Brandon. I'll let you get the last word, and before you got to go.
I think one of the things that definitely hurt Lori Lightfoot during her tenure was her reversal on major policy things that she pushed for in the campaign. And you have a great excerpt inside your book where you detail a meeting she had during the transition with Rahm Emanuel, talking about the elected school board, and he's trying to urge her not to do the elected school board. And she's like, oh, yeah, no, I'm not doing that. And he's surprised because he's like, whoa, that was easy. And automatically he gets a feeling of can't really trust this woman.
Like with the elected school board, I mean, that was an expedient position. Whether she ever believed it or not, she dumped it right away. She dumped it the day after the election, after having it in her campaign commercials 3 weeks prior. And the elected school board was an interesting thing where she put herself in a trick bag. One of my favorite chapters is Adults in the Room, which is about the fight for the elected school board in Springfield. And she was being urged by her allies, look, if you support a hybrid board, say it, go advocate for that. But she didn't want to admit that I don't support an elected school board anymore. So she nibbled around the edges and the CTU ate her lunch. And so that's how she ended up losing that fight, is because she refused to put her hands up and fight honestly about where she was. And the elected school board's a great example of flipping her position. There was a fight where her chief of staff was upset that the police department was promoting the wife of the number two in the department, Eric Carter. And Maurice Clausen, the chief of staff, is upset about it, and he wants the title of I think it's deputy chief for the guy in charge of reform. And Brown says, reforming titles, it's me and the first deputy superintendent live in it. And Maurice mocked this line forever because he's like, no, it is titles. It is the structure. It is the organization. And Mayor Lightfoot took the side of the leadership that she had appointed versus the people that she had rode with. You know, Mayor Lightfoot is very pro-police and nobody believes it except for the people that hate police. And they don't. And, you know, so the people that love police think she hates police. And the people who hate police think she loves police. She can't convince her friends they're her friend. She's their friend.
Greg, good seeing you, man. I got to bounce out.
Yeah.
I'll see you guys later.
Take care, Brandon Pope.
See you, Brandon.
I really love how you end the book. And I'm interested, you put the four Chicago stars and you say, like, one more thing about how great Chicago is and your optimism for Chicago. You feel optimistic. You think we have what it takes to continue to be a great major metropolitan city despite our inability to elect the best mayor for our needs.
And it's not just because I don't want the people of Chicago to burn down my house. It's that my neighbors and my lifelong neighbors. The city is bigger than one mayor. You know, we think that the most important person in the city of Chicago is usually the mayor. And then the number two most important person is the quarterback of the Bears. And the quarterback of the Bears usually sucks. And it is what it is. And the city survives. I think that, Mayor Johnson has his struggles and he could be a one-termer and he could figure it out, as I talk about in the book. But this is a city with a lot of resources. This is a city next to the river and with a river running through it and the lake, and it's beautiful. And it's got a variety of strengths, of transit, of nature. And so it's hard to say that one bad mayor or two bad mayors are going to make a difference. Now, if you get three and four bad mayors, I might start to feel a little differently. But you know what? The city of Chicago is a working city. It's a city of real people, and I believe in it.
We talked about the Mayor Lightfoot's biggest mistake in office. I think one of her biggest mistakes so far after leaving office is not sitting down with Gregory for an interview with this book. There are a lot of stories in here that he reached out to her as he explains to sit down and talk, and she refused. I don't know if she's saving it for her own book, but this book is likely to stand as the definitive history of these 4 years, and any sort of self-serving tome that Mayor Lightfoot writes will probably be on the same remainder bookshelf as the book that Rod Blagojevich wrote defending himself. I mean, it just, you know, so it was really, I think, a big mistake of hers to no comment him, to sit down and not say, well, this is why this happened. This is my thing. This is what I regret. This is what you didn't understand about me. I don't think it could have been worse for her. Greg, you might disagree with me, but I think that if she sits down, at least there's some shading perhaps to some of these stories or some other side. And I think it was a big mistake on her part not to sit down and have it out with Greg.
Do you know
why? Knowing how defensive she is and the kind of ways she was communicating in real time about all these things, Greg, you sure she couldn't have made it worse?
Well, I think that she and I have always had good conversations. I think that we would have had some good conversations. I think it would have been worthwhile to get some of her perspective. I do have a lot of her perspective from the emails and from the text messages in real time, which doesn't have the shading. I do think it was a mistake for her not to talk to me. And I'll say this very immodestly. And I do think that our coverage for the Tribune and in this book was the best coverage of her administration. Obviously, I have a lot of great competitors on the City Hall Press Corps, and I respect them all. But I'm really proud of our work. I think we got in there pretty good. I'm not the only one she refused to talk to, though. You know, she refused to talk to Heather Sharon from WTTW. She refused to talk to Fran Spielman from the Sun-Times, both excellent journalists and competitors. That sulking that, you know, you were mean to me and now I'm you you didn't value me the way I feel valued, is a big part of why she's not mayor anymore. Of just put on your big boy and your big girl pants, which is always my advice to the politicians, and go explain yourself and go talk about what's going on. I would read a Lori Lightfoot book that is honest. I would probably, I'll read a Lori Lightfoot book that's not honest because I'm going to have to. But she could write a good book, but I would imagine it's going to be a lot of, I was out there doing the right thing and all these big, mean people were deciding to join up with Ed Burke and with Stacey Davis Gates to bring me down.
I always wondered if her problem was more not being able to shed some of the qualities that she had to have as a Black woman, openly gay lawyer in the legal world back in the 1980s. But the 1980s were no joke either. They were pretty sexist, the 1980s also. They were getting better, but she had to be really tough, I am sure, at that point. Tougher, I'm sure, often than her male comrades. Was her inability to get past that whole I'm the toughest person in the room, do you think it was maybe more about not being a politician? This is her first experience as an elected official, or more not being able to shed those qualities that she had to have to succeed to begin with?
You know, she used to say, I'm not a politician. And as Alderman Gil Villegas used to say, once you run for elected office, you are a politician.
Right.
And so that's a little bit of delusion right there. She never stopped viewing every problem as a prosecutor problem, and you can't prosecute your way out of every problem. If you have a budget hole, you don't go out there and say, LAZ, hey, parking meter people, pay up, we're going to sue you. That's not how that works, as much as we'd like it to work. And of course, usually she's not going after the unpopular parking meter company. She's fighting with everybody else. Her problem is that she couldn't adapt her personality or her style or her leadership.
Yeah.
And you can't treat everybody the same. You can't beat everybody up the same. And so she would get the wrong lesson. Like, she would beat up Ed Burke on her first city council meeting, and everybody applauded that because Ed Burke was being stupid that day. And there's no question he was being stupid. I mean, he really screwed up.
What are you talking about there? What was the mistake he was making?
Well, he got up and he was messing with her introduction of the rules, and he starts to say, Madam Mayor, there's a problem with the rules, and his cross examiner and his like he's giving an old speech in the old Roman Empire. And she says, what's the problem, Alderman? He says, you see, it's not gender neutral. And he looked ridiculous. She sounded ridiculous. It was preposterous. And she kicked his butt. And she sat him down and made him look silly. And that's fine. I mean, Burke was being stupid that day. But not everybody is being stupid every single time that you're beating them up. And so she learned the wrong lesson again I beat up Ed Burke so I can beat up other people. And it's like, you can only beat someone up when they deserve it.
Well, that first day, I think everybody applauded that she said that. I think a lot of us liked that she said she was going to eliminate the prerogative that the alderman had, but she wasn't able to do that. How do you score that one, Greg?
It was just unnecessary. I mean, it was kind of cool, but like, she turned around and told them that they're crooks, essentially. And that's how they took it. And they remember that. They remember that, and they would complain about it all the time.
Well, some of them were.
But now you're talking about her inaugural speech.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were all sitting in back of her.
Yes.
And she basically railed on corruption and government and turned around and was like, hey, you got to stand up and applaud too and admit that you're crooks. I have always wondered, did anyone ever tell you, like, whose idea was that? Was that her idea? Because
that was just
insane.
It was impromptu. She just did it.
Wow, that was her idea. Wow.
What's your take of her? We'll let you go on this, Greg. We appreciate your time today. And I'll second Eric's recommendation of your book, The City is Up for Grabs, How Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot Led and Lost a City in Crisis. But now she is investigating the mayor of Dalton and how that city is being run. You think she's the right person for that job? It's interesting that she's come back now to Chicago to investigate another mayor.
The people of Dalton deserve good government, and they're not getting it. And so hopefully that can be beneficial. I think that Mayor Lightfoot sees herself, and she would tell you this if she came on and was feeling frisky, that she sees herself as a Girl Scout. is the way she says it when she's perked up and she's selling herself. She's like, I'm a Girl Scout. I think that psychologically, and this is one of the reasons she had problems, is she needs to see herself as the good guy. And in this situation, she sees herself as very clearly the good guy taking on Tiffany Henyard. And she thinks that it will present that way. And she also, so she's in a situation where she gets to play the good guy, and she has the, she feels like she's the good guy, and she's going to make $30,000, yeah, which is also a benefit.
$400 an hour.
She doesn't have any special powers there. She's going to write a report based off of publicly available information, more or less. I mean, there'll be a little bit more to it. I think the situation is a circus that doesn't need more circus to it. It doesn't need the added drama of a Chicago mayor getting involved. But that said, I hope that it ends with a good result, because it combines two of my reporting loves, which is the South Suburbs and Mayor Lightfoot. And so that part is interesting to me, but the whole situation's a mess.
Isn't it right up her alley as a prosecutor? This is an illegal investigation of charges against not only the mayor, but the trustee Andrew Holmes, who is the go-to guy for any community that's faced with tragedy. He shows up on TV constantly as the local hero, and now it turns out he is being accused of being the aggressor. It's a terrible story, but it's her thing, right?
It's in her wheelhouse as a former prosecutor and as a corporate lawyer, but it's also just a big old mess.
Is she going to go back to practicing law? She's not. I mean, she's in her early 60s right now. Is that her age?
She's at one of these big firms that does investigations for law firms and for corporations. So she's got a job again.
And she was an adjunct professor at Harvard, wasn't she? Wasn't she teaching a class there?
She taught a seminar.
That was ironic, wasn't it? About how to be a big city mayor, right? Someone
who failed. Working with media, right?
That was before the book was written. Greg, thanks for joining us. I'll ask you to join us on the radio sometime, but we sure appreciate you giving us your thoughts today.
I greatly appreciate it, and thank you all for reading and for having me on.
It's Greg Pratt.
Bye.
As he clicks out, this is my write-up. Whatever you want to say about Joe Biden, Donald Trump, J.B. Pritzker, Brandon Johnson, Lori Lightfoot, or Napoleon Bonaparte, the most colorful, creative, and probably corrupt politician we know today is Dalton Mayor Tiffany Henyard. Profligate spending, lack of transparency, to say nothing of a brash, self-serving style, promoted on tax-supported billboards, have persuaded the township supervisors to hire former Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot to investigate. Never mind the first-class junkets across the country, staying in five-star hotels with an entourage, and the curious or ridiculous amount of personal security services the town's police department provides her. The damnedest thing to me they've done in Dalton is pass an ordinance that lowers the salary of the position that she currently holds if someone else takes it. Currently, as township supervisor, Henyard earns $224,000 a year. She's up for re-election in a couple of years, and the new rule stipulates that if she's defeated, if someone else gets her seat, the pay drops to $25,000 from $224,000. What a three-ring circus that is. It's a town of like 20,000 people, right? A township? It's Dalton's small.
It's a decent-sized suburb. You really have to feel sorry for the people of Dalton. I mean, what does a mayor have to do to top her predecessor being William Shaw? Bill Shaw, former state rep, state senator, twin brother of Alderman Bob Shaw. I mean, you really have to be something else to make his days now seem like nothing. And he hired Bob Shaw, his twin brother, to be like inspector general for like $70,000 in some of his last years in office. So, I mean, the poor people of Dalton have just been inundated.
Let his brother sub for him, right? Sometimes he'd show up if
that's what they
said. Switched they off from time to time because they were identical twins.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
You couldn't really tell them apart. They had a slightly different haircut. But
and they kept those rumors going, yeah.
They did. They did not deny it.
They both had giant toupees, but it was like they had the same toupee.
Yes. Total twins.
Did that proposal to lower the salary of her predecessor or her successor pass? Did they actually pass?
It did, because it also does it for some of the other supervisors. So if their seats are occupied by other supervisors, then the pay for those people go down. Now, it hasn't been challenged, and her opponent's legal representation says this is the definition of an illegal ordinance, that this will not pass muster. But nobody's challenged it yet because nobody's run against him yet. So that it's sitting on the books. It has no immediate effect, Eric.
Oh, so they're all doing it down there. All the trustees are doing it so that they're not going to get any challengers.
It is so brazen. The fact that they fly first class to these cities and run up huge bills at nice restaurants for no ostensible purpose. And then when asked about it, she said, "Why are you challenging a black woman? I'm a black woman and you should support me." She doesn't seem to care a fig about all
Dalton is a very diverse suburb now, so she's not going to get away with that for very long. If you've seen on the news the last couple of town meetings, the crowds of Dalton, you know, people who are clamoring to get in and they are mad. I think the voters there are not going to put up with it for very much longer. Maybe that's why the trustees were willing to vote to pay Lori Lightfoot and be like, "Oh, let's take care of this now."
And also, she has those giant posters with, you know, her face, sometimes almost a full body poster. They're giant, owning the city and telling everybody how great she is as a mayor. That's the kind of thing like Jane Byrne used to, didn't she spray painted with a decal Jane Byrne City of Chicago on the sidewalk, for example, and people were kind of outraged by claiming that kind of real estate. But these are blatant. They're giant posters.
They're
of
big vanity projects.
Town.
She has an attractive look on the billboard. It would be like if she were some celebrity or something.
It's lovely.
I know. She's all made up. It's really something. Marge, comment to me on Donald Trump's evolving position on abortion, which today is let the states decide on an individual basis. Is his movement a good thing, a bad thing, or is it an indifferent political move? Does it help him?
Is it a thing at all? No, he's not moving in any way. And it's maddening to watch this being portrayed as now Trump has come softened on the question of abortion, become more moderate. John, here's what let the states decide means. It lets the red states that are anti-abortion, that are increasingly fixated on taking away a woman's autonomy and their right to decide their own future and health matters. So what they do is these states put out these increasingly detailed and focused different laws, and they're challenging the Supreme Court. How far can we go in whittling away women's rights? Let's try this 1864 law and see if it works. Let's try vague language about protecting the health of a woman, which Trump now says, he says, yes, have an abortion if the woman's life is in danger. Well, in practice, what happens is doctors don't know what the point of inflection is, right? So we're hearing these stories about women who literally are waiting in the parking lot of a clinic or a hospital, bleeding, suffering, in pain, because the doctors say, no, not yet. You're not close enough to death yet. We don't know if we're going to go to jail for giving you an abortion and rescuing your life. So what he's saying is, okay, states, it's a wink, right? It's a big wink to the red states that are increasingly hammering these laws, trying as many creative ways as they can to force women to have children when they and their families aren't ready for it. Let's stop the pill. Let's stop mail order. Let's try to arrest women who cross state lines to get the rights that our state won't grant them. You know, let's try to extradite people from Illinois who are escorting women who come there from Alabama to have an abortion. They're trying one thing after another. Leave it to the states means let the states communicate to the Supreme Court that he chose specifically to take away Roe v. Wade and women's rights and see how far we can get with it. That's my speech. Well,
but it's also at the same time, Arch, it's not satisfying the people who are in the strong opposition to abortion rights camp. They are dismayed because he didn't come out for a nationwide ban, that he didn't. I mean, you know, because, you know, they'll push for 15 weeks and then they'll say, well, 15 weeks is too much. Then we'll go to 9, then we'll go to 6. And then you'll end up with a law like in Arizona. I think that this is a really, really bad week for the president, our former president, because of the decision in Arizona to reinstate that law from the 19th century. And it signals to a lot of voters that this is what the Republicans want to do, that they, there's no give in that. I mean, they're not saying, well, it'll be fine with us if there's abortions in Illinois. No, there's no way. There's no way that the anti-abortion zealots are going to let that stand. I mean, there are a lot of people who are not totally comfortable with the idea of abortion, but who would be willing to have some sort of a compromise, maybe go back to Roe v. Wade, which was a workable compromise for 50 years. But I think this is going to bring out voters. I think that Florida is now in play because of what's gone on down there. I think Arizona's in play. And the Republicans are, I think Mark Jacob sometimes on the Mincing Rascals said something like, they're like the dog that caught the car and then they've thrown themselves in front of the car. That there's no way for them to square the circle on this, because any position that is really strongly anti-abortion is going to have to start getting rid of in vitro fertilization. That's where the logic takes you.
That's where Alabama went.
And the Republicans in Congress have refused to pass legislation protecting IVF. So this is a big problem for the Republicans, because they're out of step with about two-thirds of the country.
Well, what about the notion, though, that states should have the right to make their own laws about guns, about the way we vote? How is this not aligned with that principle that we have 50 states and the people in that state are sovereign? We're part of a federal confederation, but it's logical that a state in Arizona would have a different law than a state in Illinois, than the state of Illinois, right?
On some issues, but not guns, for instance. The federal courts and Supreme Court are always overturning state bans on guns. Those are always being fought.
There are different laws about guns in Chicago and Illinois than there are in other cities and states.
Right, but there are extreme limits to what those laws can do, because people will run to the Supreme Court and call it unconstitutional. I think the question here is whether it is a fundamental right, whether reproductive freedom is a fundamental right, whether abortion is essentially a fundamental right up to a certain point. And it's not one of these ones that a state can go, well, yeah, you can have it there, you don't have to have it there. It's really a question of what sort of a right this is. Yeah, states can have different speed limits and different sales taxes and all that, but those don't get to this kind of fundamental autonomy question.
And what about the pushback against the abortion pill, the morning after pill, where now there are some states who don't want you to be able to get it from states where it is legal to sell it? You know, don't mail it to Alabama, or don't, you know, this there. We are a nation of states, and the founding fathers did their best at delineating exactly that line that Eric is talking about. And yeah, we have different gun laws, and look at what Indiana's gun laws are doing to the people of Chicago. Indiana's gun laws are killing the people of Chicago because they don't regulate gun show sales, and Chicagoans who want to deal in guns, or Indianans who want to deal in guns, fill their trunks, drive over here, get them out on the street. There's a lot easier way to stop those guns than pulling over a guy that you think might have missed his seatbelt lock. Go to Indiana, where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. Except we can't. We're a nation of states, and that's the fundamental defining factor of this country. Are we going to eradicate that?
I don't get that point, Marge. We are a nation of different states with different views. People in Indiana may think that Chicago is doing it wrong.
The nation part you're missing. It's like I live in a high rise. Can I play my music as loud as I want? Can I sit on my balcony and set off a noxious fire? Or no, can you burn leaves in the city of Chicago in your backyard? No, because we all breathe that air. There are laws that affect the community. It's the nation part.
Well, let me press you on this.
Okay,
but Donald Trump is suggesting, or what people who are trying to rationalize his view would say, is that Illinois, you should feel no jeopardy if, in fact, the people in Chicago and Illinois want to have the abortion rights and rules that we do in Illinois. You're sovereign. You get to have your own choices. That's the way it is now, and that's what Donald Trump is trying to, as he's threading this needle, assure everybody. Do you think that, in fact, we will lose the rights and privileges we have in Illinois?
They're already trying to. They're trying to make it illegal for us to provide services to women who come here from a state that won't allow them to have them in their home
but
state.
But that's
to extradite. They're going to the Supreme Court, and they're going to whittle and whittle and whittle until they are attacking our rights as a blue state and trying to inflict their red state laws.
They're
on
doing
us.
That on their red state citizens. They're not doing that to people. They're not inflicting that on blue state Illinoisans.
They want to make it illegal to assist a woman from Alabama who gets an abortion.
I think that's my point. That's the problem for a woman in Alabama. I sound terribly unsympathetic. I don't mean to be. I'm just trying to talk about the very principle that Alabama and Illinois are different places.
I see what you're saying, John. I mean, and for those of us, which I think include all of us who wish it was still a national right, we feel sorry for the people in the states like Alabama and Texas who are going through this. But now that it is not a national right, ultimately their population, if they feel strongly enough about it, are going to have to change their state legislatures, get them to vote them some rights, because that is the way it works.
Amen to that. So
let's face it, we would be outraged if someplace like Alabama was trying to impose their opinion on us.
Kate, I think that's why my question was, do you think this is going to help hurt, or is this a neutral position for the Republicans that are aligning
for
themselves?
The Republicans?
Well, for Donald Trump, say,
for
or
Donald,
the Republicans.
For Donald Trump, I still feel like I think abortion is going to break more against him, as Eric was pointing out, because I definitely think it's going to work against the Republicans. But the problem is that Biden still has so much going against him, against his position on Israel, and of course immigration. So I'm not feeling like really sanguine that abortion is going to work enough against the Republicans to make up for it for Biden on his other two issues.
Well, maybe it's not a cure-all.
So up in the air.
But this is going to help Democrats, is going to help.
Trump thinks so, or else he wouldn't have been, you know, backtracking today.
Oh, sure.
He was, you know, first he says, well, you know, Arizona's going to fix this. He's signaling to them they better fix it. And then an hour later, he's saying, well, he wouldn't sign a national ban if it came to his desk. Of course, he lies enough.
Anything.
I don't believe him.
Right.
I know that
right.
He can say whatever he wants. But obviously, he's worried about it, John.
I really think that this is going to break bad for the Republicans, and they don't really know how to address this issue because there is very little middle ground that satisfies anyone and still satisfies their base.
Emails to the Mincing Rascals. Hello, John. I've been a longtime listener to the Mincing Rascals, but that ended today. I would love to be able to vote for someone other than President Biden or former President Trump. But the hardest pill for me to swallow is how Eric Zorn is obsessed with President Trump and makes unbelievable claims about Republicans in generalized fashion. Not long ago, he stated Republicans don't even like to have sex for fun. Then, on this week's podcast, he claims Republicans are trying to eliminate IVF. Eric, you want to respond to that in any way?
Well, I did respond to this in my Picayune Plus issue for Tuesday, which is available to anyone who wants to read it online. I addressed this letter. But, you know, obviously Republicans have sex for fun, but they don't want – I think that a lot of them don't want other people to have sex for fun. I think that my feeling has long been that opposition to non-procreative sex animates a lot of the religious and political opposition to abortion, and I think we see that when we talk about, you know, rape and incest exemptions for pregnancy and so on. I think that there, like I say, there have been there's a bill introduced to protect IVF in Congress. Republicans voted against it, and opposition to IVF is completely consistent with this idea that animates the entire opposition to abortion rights, which is that life begins at the moment of conception.
Yeah.
And IVF is not consistent with life beginning at the moment of conception. And am I obsessed with Donald Trump? I am obsessed with the idea that this country could be ruined if he is reelected. So, and I don't apologize for that. So I'm sorry we lost a listener, but We have so many other sensible people on the panel. I don't know why he would pick on me.
You can always email us. Just send it to me, John Williams, at WGNradio.com. Marge, Kate, and Eric. Brandon had to click out a little while ago, and thanks, too, to Greg Pratt for being part of the podcast. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week. Okay, guys. Very good. Very good.
All right. I don't think we made that guy any happier today. At least I didn't, probably.
No.
And he's not listening anymore, at least supposedly, right?
Oh, they are.
They do.
I know you guys know this, but it's pretty funny to me. And my colleague here, Steve Bertrand, and I will often get letters like this or text messages. Steve calls him. He actually just calls him when they're text, and he goes, "What?" And I don't do that, but I email them back or I text them back, and they can't believe that I've responded with civility. And then they're so appreciative and like, "Oh, I was just saying that." It almost always ends that way. People who say the meanest, most cutting, most definitive things, like, "I'm never listening to you again." And then love the show. Love the show.
But there's that one woman, I can't remember her name, John, who used to write all the time. Used to write us every week almost like, I can't believe I'm so mad about this. I'm never going to listen again. And then 2 weeks later, I can't believe you. I'm never going to listen again.
And her big beef was always that we weren't uploading the podcast quick enough. One of her problems was, she goes, why do I have to wait until 8 o'clock?
to get furious at you guys.
Okay? I know. I'm like, why are you even listening at 7 o'clock? Okay.
Wow. Well, maybe your inclination and Steve's to be friendly with those who might criticize you would have been a helpful tip for Lori Lightfoot.
How about it?
Hey, we should. I thought Greg was great. I would love to just if he would come on every couple of months anyway, because he's good.
He's really in the room.
I like him. He's in the room, as they say. Yeah. Good talking to you.
Okay. Thanks, Kate.
Bye.
Thank you.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.